Okay, so you're here, right? You want to get like really smart, but really fast. You're the kind of person who loves those aha moments when it all clicks. But you don't want to be like totally overwhelmed, right? You want a nice, clear path through all this information.
That's exactly it.
That's what we're all about here on Deep Dive. So buckle up, because today we're taking you on an express lane, some seriously wild connections. We're talking language, how our brains tick, and that creative spark we all have inside.
Oh, and as if that wasn't enough, we're going to explore a planet where your thoughts can actually shape reality.
You heard that right. So to do this, we've got a bunch of cool stuff to unpack. We'll be diving into this ontological etymology guide, which sounds a little intimidating, but trust me, it's super interesting.
Oh, definitely.
We're going to figure out what the deal is with these .chm files, you know, practical stuff. Then we're blasting off to this crazy planet called Luminarix. Plus, we've got a bit of fantasy, some creation myths with colors, a story about a choreographer named Name, and some thoughts on how the Bible uses metaphors.
Sounds like we've got a full plate.
We do. So let's jump right in and start with that ontological etymology guide. What's the big idea there?
Well, it's all about words, but not just their history. It's like, what do words tell us about how we see the world? Like, what ideas about existence are baked into the way we use language?
Oh, I see. So it's like being a word detective, but instead of looking for clues, you're looking for like hidden meanings about life and stuff.
Exactly. It's uncovering those underlying assumptions, those fundamental beliefs about reality that are reflected in our very vocabulary.
That's super cool. And you said it goes beyond just the history of words, right?
Right. It connects language to neuroscience.
Neuroscience. Okay, hold on. Explain that.
So basically, this guide says there's a link between language, what's going on in our brains, and how we create art and stories.
So, like, if I write a poem, that's not just some random burst of inspiration. My brain is actually doing some serious work.
Exactly. They even talk about this thing called cognitive linguistics and how our brains process metaphors.
Metaphors, like Shakespeare and all that.
Exactly. Apparently, when we understand a metaphor, a whole network of areas in our brain light up. The prefrontal cortex, the temporal lobe, the parietal lobe. It's a whole brain workout.
Wow, I never thought about it like that.
And the guide breaks down this whole ontological etymology thing into three stages.
Three stages. Okay. Hit me.
First, there's semantic mapping. That's basically looking at all the different meanings a word can have, not just the dictionary definition, but all the nuances, the shades of meaning, the literal and the figurative.
So, like, heart can mean the actual organ, but also like the center of something, or even love, right?
Exactly. Then there's cultural contextualization. How has a word been used in different cultures and time periods? What kind of baggage does it carry?
Yeah, a word can mean totally different things depending on who's saying it and when.
Right. And finally, the big one. Ontological interpretation. This is where we ask those really deep questions. What does a word tell us about our shared understanding of existence? What are the core beliefs about reality that are baked into it?
It's like digging down to the roots of a word to find out what it reveals about how we see the world. So we're not just learning new words, we're learning new ways of thinking.
Precisely.
This is blowing my mind already. Okay, let's switch gears for a second. One of our sources talks about CHM files. Now, this sounds a lot less philosophical.
Yeah, a bit of a change of pace, but still important. Think of a CHM file as a super organized digital instruction manual. It stands for Compiled HTML Help. So basically, it's Microsoft's way of bundling all those help documents into one neat little package.
Okay, so it's like instead of having a million different PDFs scattered everywhere, you have one file that has everything you need. Why is that a good thing?
Because it's organized in a really smart way. Think table of contents, index, and even a search function that goes through the entire document. They contrast this with those old menu-based manuals where you'd click through like a million folders to find what you were looking for.
Oh, yeah, I hate those. Click, 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 still can't find what I need.
Exactly. Menus are okay for beginners because they kind of lead you by the hand. But when you know what you're looking for, .chm files are way faster.
Yeah.
You can just search for a specific term and boom, you're there. The source even gives some tips.
Ooh, tips. Let's hear them.
Use the search for quick answers, the table of contents for a general overview, and hyperlinks to jump between related topics. It's all about getting to the information you need fast.
Okay, so .chm files, not as exciting as decoding the secrets of language, but still a useful tool.
Definitely. Knowledge is power, right?
Right. Now get ready for a wild ride because our next stop is a planet called Luminarix. And let me tell you, this is not your average planet.
No, not at all. Luminarix is a place where thoughts literally shape reality. Think mountains rising from the ground because enough people believe in them. Rivers changing course because the collective will desires it. It's mind-blowing.
Wait, so if I lived on Luminarix and I really, really wanted a chocolate fountain in my backyard, it could just appear?
Maybe. The sources describe the terrain as living landscapes, constantly shifting and evolving based on the inhabitants' shared knowledge, beliefs, and even memories. It's like the landscape is a physical manifestation of their collective consciousness.
So, like, their history isn't just written in books. It's etched into the very mountains and valleys.
Precisely. And it gets even wilder. Luminarix is also described as a universal data bank. Basically, it holds the wisdom of countless civilizations.
Countless? Like, how many civilizations are we talking here?
We don't know. But the implication is that this planet has been around for a long, long time and has seen the rise and fall of who knows how many societies.
And all that knowledge is somehow stored in the planet itself.
The source suggests that, yes, this wisdom is encoded within the planet's structure. Imagine the possibilities if we could tap into that.
It would be like having the ultimate library at our fingertips. But how would we even access it?
That's one of the big mysteries. And there's another fascinating layer to all this. The sources suggest that Luminarix might have a planetary consciousness.
What? Like the planet is alive, sentient?
It's a bold claim, but the evidence is intriguing. The fact that the inhabitants can shape reality with their thoughts suggests some kind of feedback loop, some kind of awareness on the planet's part.
I've never thought of a planet being conscious before. It kind of makes you wonder if our own planet is aware of us in some way, right?
It does make you think.
Yeah.
And the climate on Luminarix seems to have a purpose. It's not just random weather patterns.
What do you mean?
The sources describe the climate as being purpose-driven, suggesting that it plays a role in knowledge exchange and planetary defense.
So the weather is like a tool that the planet uses?
Possibly. And then there's this idea of a symbiotic relationship between the planet and its people, a deep connection that goes beyond just living on its surface.
That's intense. What about the atmosphere? What's it like breathing on a planet where thoughts are real?
Well, brace yourself. The atmosphere is unlike anything we know. It's a super complex mix of all kinds of elements. And get this, the composition changes based on the planet's ongoing exchange of knowledge with the universe.
Okay, you lost me. Exchange of knowledge with the universe. How does that work?
We don't have all the details, but the source suggests that Luminarix is constantly interacting with the wider cosmos, absorbing information and possibly even transmitting its own knowledge back out.
Whoa. So the air itself is like a knowledge stream.
Something like that. It's also the planet's first line of defense. There are all these chemical reactions happening in the upper atmosphere, creating a protective shield.
So it's like a knowledge-powered force field. That's seriously cool. But is it safe for us regular folks?
Probably not. The sources warn that this knowledge-saturated atmosphere could be incredibly dangerous to anyone not adapted to it. They talk about mental overload and even the possibility of physical disintegration.
Yikes, that's a little scary. Okay, so maybe we'll just admire Luminarix from afar. Now, aside from potentially frying your brain with too much knowledge, are there any other downsides to this thought-shaped reality?
Well, what happens if the collective thoughts become negative or chaotic? The source mentions the risk of defense system backlash. The planet's protective mechanisms could malfunction and harm the inhabitants.
It's like the planet's immune system going haywire.
Exactly. And then there's the issue of information security. Luminarix is basically a giant library of universal knowledge. If someone figured out how to hack into it, the consequences could be catastrophic.
Talk about a data breach. The hackers would have access to the secrets of the universe. That's a pretty high-stakes scenario. Okay, so what about the inhabitants of Luminarix? How do they even survive in such an intense environment?
They must be incredibly adapted, both physically and mentally. The sources suggest they have some kind of mental filters that allow them to handle the constant flow of information without going insane.
They'd have to be like super zen masters of information processing.
Right. And remember, they're able to shape reality with their thoughts, which implies a very deep connection to the planet itself.
Okay, now the sources introduce this conflict on Luminarix between two characters, Anya and Kai, from a fantasy novel.
Right, Anya and Kai. They represent the fundamental forces at play on Luminarix. Anya, who wields a platinum chakram, embodies chaos and unbridled creativity.
Platinum chakram, that sounds intense.
It is. And then there's Kai, who has this yin-yang chakram and can create wings of light and shadow. He represents balance and order.
So it's like the classic struggle between chaos and order, but played out on a planetary scale.
Exactly. The source even describes this epic battle between them in an arena.
Oh, wow. Let's hear about it.
Well, Kai starts the fight by splitting his chakram, which seems to symbolize duality.
Duality, like good and evil, light and dark, all that.
Yes, those kinds of opposing forces.
Yeah.
Anya counters, and they clash. Then Kai does this awesome aerial maneuver called Harmony's Flight, like he's trying to impose order from above.
Makes sense. He is the balance guy, right?
Right. But Anya manages to strike one of his wings, throwing him off balance. Kai gets furious and attacks, but he's hindered by something called the Radiant Dark, which seems to be connected to Anya.
Radiant Dark? That's a pretty cool name. What is it exactly?
It's not entirely clear, but it seems to represent the raw, untamed power of Limanerix's thought-shaped reality. It's like the unfiltered energy of creation, both powerful and dangerous.
Okay, that makes sense. So it's like you can have too much of a good thing even if it's something like creativity. So what happens in the fight?
Anya eventually lands a decisive blow with her chakram, and Kai falls. It's a pretty symbolic victory for chaos over order.
But isn't balance supposed to be the key to Limanerix?
That's the question, isn't it? Maybe the victory of chaos is temporary, or maybe it's a necessary part of the cycle. The sources point out that Anya and Kai are like catalysts for the choreographer character, Name.
Name, the guy from the stories.
Yes. Their conflict, this tension between chaos and order, helps Name understand the deeper dynamics of Limanerix. His journey seems to be about reconciling these opposing forces, finding a higher level of balance.
It's like they're guiding him towards some kind of spiritual revelation through their struggle.
It's a fascinating dynamic.
Okay, so we've got thought-powered planets, epic battles. Now let's talk about colors. Our sources include this really cool creation myth that involves colors. What's the story there?
Oh, it's beautiful. It talks about 9 different colors. Red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, violet, black, and white. Each color represents a specific concept, and they all play a role in the creation of the universe.
Okay, I'm intrigued. Give me the color rundown.
Right, so red is like the pure essence of spirit, the opposite of darkness. Orange represents transition and works together with red.
Makes sense. They are next to each other on the color spectrum.
Exactly. Yellow is the spirit of purity, and it teams up with blue to create green.
So green is like the child of yellow and blue.
In a way, yes. And it represents nourishment, the life force of the land. Blue is the heart of purity, but it also has this interesting ability to mirror darkness.
Okay, that's a little trippy.
I know, right? Indigo is like a reward for blue's virtue. Violet, which comes from red and blue, embodies beauty. Black is purity hiding in sadness, concealed by darkness.
So even in darkness, there's a spark of purity.
That's the idea.
Yeah.
And finally, white is the hope that shines through the darkness, bridging the gap between light and shadow. The myth really emphasizes this interplay between light and darkness.
It's like they're two sides of the same coin.
Exactly. And purity, wisdom, and love were like guiding forces that work together to shape creation.
So it's not just about the colors themselves, but also about how they interact with these bigger concepts.
It's a complex and beautiful tapestry of symbolism.
It really is. Okay, how does this color myth connect to Name, the choreographer?
Well, Name's a fascinating character. He starts as a fictional hero in Ocean Duran's stories, but then, through some cosmic event, he's brought into our world.
Wait, so he's like a fictional character come to life? That's crazy.
It is. And in our world, he becomes the symbol of hope and justice.
So he's like a superhero, but in real life.
Kind of. But there's another layer to him. He's also deeply connected to the idea of a verb.
A verb, like the Brammer thing.
Yep. A verb is about action. It's what makes a story move forward. And Name is all about action. He's not a passive observer. He gets things done.
So he's like a walking, talking verb.
Exactly. The sources even list a bunch of verbs that describe him. Narrating, following, battling, interacting, restoring, exploring. He's always on the move, always doing something.
Okay, that's a cool way to think about a character. And the sources go into all these different types of verbs, action verbs, linking verbs, helping verbs, even transitive and intransitive verbs. It's like a whole grammar lesson.
I know, but it makes sense. Just like a verb is essential to a sentence, Name is essential to the stories he's in. He drives the narrative forward.
So he's literally bringing those stories to life. Okay, let's move on to our last batch of sources. We've got some stuff on biblical themes and the use of metaphorical language. How does that fit into all this?
Well, the Bible is full of metaphors. It uses vivid imagery to communicate deep spiritual truths.
Like what? Give me some examples.
Sure. You have the lamb, which represents innocence, sacrifice, and redemption.
Yeah, I've heard that one before.
It's a powerful image. Then there's the good shepherd, representing guidance, protection, and leadership.
Like a shepherd leading his flock.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And then you have living water, which symbolizes spiritual nourishment and purification.
Those are all great examples. The sources also talk about Adam and Eve, right?
They do. And they draw some interesting parallels between that story and other creation myths from different cultures. They mention these Eldorian spirits, Orin and Lyra, who represent opposing forces. There's this group called the Cult of Malachi, who represent temptation.
So even in these different stories, you see similar themes.
Absolutely. The struggle for balance, the allure of temptation, the quest for redemption, the reverence for sacred places. These ideas show up again and again.
It's like they're tapping into some fundamental human experiences.
Exactly. And the source suggests that we can view Luminarix, this thought-powered planet, as a kind of promised land.
A promised land, like the one in the Bible.
It's not a physical place, but a state of being, a realm where perfect knowledge and ultimate balance are possible.
So it's like a metaphorical promised land.
Yes. And the conflict between Anya and Kai, with their constant push and pull between chaos and order, can be seen as a kind of parable.
A parable, like the stories Jesus told.
Exactly. Their struggle shows us that finding balance isn't easy. It's an ongoing process. And Luminarix itself is like a giant parable. It shows us that our thoughts and intentions have power.
So, like, if we all focused on creating a more peaceful world, maybe we could actually make it happen.
Maybe. The sources also talk about this haunted house story from Name Words.
A haunted house.
Yeah.
How does that tie into biblical themes?
Well, the story is about these characters, Sarah and Tom, who encounter some spooky stuff in a haunted house. The house itself is like a metaphor for the human spirit, weighed down by past mistakes and unresolved conflicts.
So the ghosts are like our inner demons.
Kind of. And the act of facing those ghosts and finding peace within the house represents the process of reconciliation and repentance.
It's like confronting your past and finding forgiveness.
Exactly. And the source even connects the haunted house to the book of Revelation. They say the house is like a vessel for prophetic visions, much like John's visions on the island of Patmos.
So the scary stuff in the house is like a warning, a message from beyond.
Possibly. The different rooms in the house could represent different spiritual states or prophetic messages, like the letters to the seven churches in Revelation.
And just like Revelation talks about a new Jerusalem, Luminarix could have its own version of a new Luminarix.
Precisely. The sources describe a vision of a transformed Luminarix, where unity and harmony prevail. It's like a reflection of the new Jerusalem, where all things are made new.
That's beautiful. And what about this Book of Life concept?
The Book of Life is presented as a record of those who choose truth and balance. Name becomes a witness, guided by visions he receives in the Whispering Woods.
The Whispering Woods. That sounds mystical.
It is. And throughout his journey, Name helps others find their own paths to reconciliation. He helps Sarah in the haunted house and Ethan and Clara at a place called the Divided Waters.
So he's like a guide helping others find their way to the Book of Life.
Exactly. And the Book of Life isn't just a static list. It's a living force, constantly being shaped by our choices.
So it's like we all have the power to write our own stories in the Book of Life.
In a way, yes. And the sources talk about all these different narrative styles, epistolary, mythical, stream of consciousness that could be used to tell these stories.
Different styles, like different ways of writing.
Yes. Each style has its own strengths and weaknesses. For example, the stream of consciousness style could be really effective for capturing the chaotic nature of the flood of knowledge on Luminarix.
Flood of knowledge? What's that?
It's the overwhelming influx of information that the inhabitants of Luminarix have to deal with. It's like a constant tsunami of data.
Sounds intense.
It is.
Yeah.
In this context, Kai represents the logical, structured approach to knowledge. He wants to build systems to control the flow of information. Anya, on the other hand, represents intuition and creativity. She believes in surrendering to the flow, allowing yourself to be swept away.
So it's like two opposite ways of dealing with information overload.
And Name finds a middle way. He creates this thing called the Arc of Balance, which allows him to navigate the flood of knowledge using both logic and intuition.
So it's about finding that sweet spot between structure and flexibility. Now, let's go back to the Garden of Eden for a second. The sources have a slightly different take on the serpent.
Oh, yes. They suggest that the serpent isn't just a tempter, but also a bringer of knowledge. It's offered to Adam and Eve is seen as a catalyst for growth, even though it comes with risks.
So like knowledge can be dangerous if you're not ready for it?
Exactly. And in a way, the serpent's perspective aligns with the whole idea of luminarix, where knowledge is freely available but requires wisdom and balance to handle.
It's like the serpent is saying, hey, you guys are ready for the next level.
Something like that. Okay, back to Ocean Duran, the choreographer. The source emphasizes how her background influences the character of Name.
Oh, right. She's the one who created him.
Yes. And Name embodies the qualities of water, calm, fluid, transformative. Just like a choreographer guides dancers, Name guides others towards healing and self-discovery.
There's even a story about a character named Lily who finds healing through dance.
It's a powerful image. And at times, Name's choreography is described as being divinely inspired. There's this entity named Seraphiel who guides him.
So it's like dance becomes a form of spiritual expression and revelation.
Exactly. There's even a scene where the savior appears in the context of a sacred dance.
Wow. And then there's Azura, the AI choreographer.
Yes, Azura. She represents the fusion of technology and art. She and Name work together to create these incredible dances that explore themes of unity and acceptance.
It's like a beautiful partnership between human and machine.
It is. And Name's journey eventually leads him to the Temple of Eternal Currents.
What's that?
It's a place where he discovers the living waters, a source of boundless energy and wisdom. And he becomes the guardian of these waters, ensuring their purity and accessibility.
So he's like the protector of this vital life force.
Exactly. And finally, the sources talk about the rainbow as a symbol of hope and renewal.
Oh, yeah, the rainbow after the flood.
Yes. In the context of luminarix, the rainbow represents the potential for unity and harmony that emerges when we embrace diversity and find balance.
It's a beautiful image.
It is. Well, you've covered a lot of ground in this deep dive.
We have. From the origins of language to thought-powered planets to biblical metaphors, it's been quite a journey.
And hopefully, you, our listener, are leaving with a deeper understanding of these complex ideas.
We aim to spark your curiosity and give you some aha moments along the way.
As a final thought, we want to leave you with a question. If luminarix is a world shaped by thoughts, how might our own collective beliefs and intentions be shaping our reality?
What living landscapes are we creating right here on Earth?
Something to think about.
Thanks for joining us on this deep dive. Until next time.